Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening and welcome to Raven's Real Spill Radio. This is your girl, Raven the Serial Poet, coming to bring to y'all another entertaining night of the 31 Days of Horror. I hope everybody's day has been good. My day has been amazing. I accomplished a lot today. And, you know, that's putting it mildly. So, tonight, it's night 15. Those of you who have been riding with me since night one, or day one, however you want to put it, y'all are the real MVPs, and y'all are showing that y'all don't mind being entertained, and y'all are showing that, you know, y'all rock with your girl. And I love that shit. So, I ain't gonna hold y'all up. Tonight, we're gonna get into some very different stories. What I found for y'all tonight, y'all gonna thoroughly enjoy. But before y'all do, the number to call in is 914-205-5813. That is 914-205-5813. Let's get into this ghost tales.
I am posting this because I am truly out of options. My employers refuse to take my reports and have even threatened termination of my contract if I bring these events back to the table again. The local authorities are dismissive, or even worse, accuse me of substance abuse and mental instability. I can't even tell my own family, lest they draw the same conclusions. I wouldn't want to drag them into this anyway. Hopefully some of you can help me, or at least help me understand what's going on. I have worked as a forester in the Appalachia for a logging company that will go unnamed for nearly a decade now. In that time, I have come to love my job, the woods, and the freedom that accompanies both. But things have started to change with my most recent assignment. The woods used to feel so safe, so clean. Now I can't stop my hands from shaking when I stand beneath the green canopy. So we're all on the same page. I'll walk you through the fieldwork of my profession. First, the company assigns me to a tract of land they have recently acquired. I do some less exciting prep work in the office, satellite imaging, GIS, property analysis, etc., and then I head out into the field. Generally, the sites are pretty far from the office, requiring multiple hour drives and overnight camping. I bring along some simple gear, tape measures, manual clinometer and altimeter, bright neon orange marking spray paint, and my GPS transmitter and marker. All in all, a bunch of technical nonsense that lets me determine the value of trees, which should be logged, and which should be left behind to ensure no permanent damage is done to the forest. Simple enough. It was early morning on September 21st, 2019, when my office desktop pinged that I had an incoming email. Seeing that it was an assignment from corporate, I opened it up and nearly let out a cheer in my cubicle. The tract that I had been assigned was a huge patch of old-growth forest, located near the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia. For those of you who don't know, an old-growth forest is a wooded area that has not been disturbed for hundreds of years, allowed to grow and develop in its natural state without intervention by farming, construction, or logging. Many old-growth forests haven't been touched since the settlers arrived, and some even before then. In any case, this was cause for celebration. Old growth is increasingly rare and amazingly beautiful, and I was the one assigned to explore it. Of course, this was bittersweet, seeing as I would be the last to see it in its undespoiled state before I gave the loggers the go-ahead. I spent the morning in my office packing my things and loading them into the tiny white Ford Ranger, lovingly nicknamed Piper, that the company had provided to me when I started working for them. She was a rugged little thing, having carried me through the mountains for almost a decade without protest. Of course, she wasn't without her quirks. Crank-operated windows, a rattling tailgate, and an AC that hadn't functioned since 2011. But I love that tiny little truck. Piper and I set out around noon, making good time on the four-hour drive through the rugged depths of West Virginia. We arrived at the old trailhead that would deliver me to my tract late into the afternoon. As I strapped my heavy backpack on and locked Piper up for her stay at the edge of the woods, I breathed deeply, taking in the heavy scent of the forest earth and the sound of the wind and birdsong through the treetops. Giving my truck a pat on the hood, I turned and made my way off the country road and onto the narrow dirt track that wound into the woods. The hike to the old-growth stand of trees took about an hour of brisk trekking, the path becoming more and more overgrown as I progressed. It was obvious this trail hadn't been consistently used for years, probably decades. Nearly to my destination, I happened across what should have been the first sign that something was not right. An ancient sycamore tree stood in the center of the path. Had it been any other species, I would have sidestepped and kept plugging ahead. But sycamores had always been my favorite trees, so I looked upwards to admire the old beauty. About 12 feet off the ground, twisted and woven through the tangle of white-barked branches, was a decomposing skeleton of a deer. Scraps of fur and mummified tendons, the only things holding it together, as it dangled from the tree. I gasped and stepped back from the initial shock, the staring skeletal visage of the old deer being the last thing I expected to see. My first thought was a mountain lion or a similar predator had hauled the animal up there to feast upon. Carnivores like that were pretty rare in the area, but I had guessed it wasn't entirely out of the question. but my confusion spiked, and the rumblings of dread gestated in my gut when I looked a bit closer. It was difficult to tell, due to the distance from the forest floor and the amount of time the deer had been up there. But as I squinted, I started to notice something haunting. The decrepit animal remains were not simply jumbled up in the tree branches. They were lashed into place by scraps of rope and cloth. Someone had hauled the deer 12 feet up in the sycamore tree and tied its limbs and joints so it would stay suspended up there. Directly beneath the nearly completely rotted animal, barely visible due to age, was carved a simple O, presumably put onto the bark by whoever took the time to create this macabre installation. I was understandably shocked and confused by this discovery, but the apparent age of the carving and carcass eased my worries a little. Whoever had done this obviously done their work months ago. I resolved that until I happened across fresher work, I was unlikely to run into anyone else out here in the woods. Having reassured myself for the moment and excited to lay eyes on the rare old growth, I carried on down the trail towards my destination. I reached the edge of my assigned stand around 6:30 at night. The old, ill-maintained trail terminating in a small clearing on the border of the forest I hiked through, and the secluded acres of old growth that waited beyond. I gazed, awestruck, at what waited for me. Ancient tree trunks that soared stories high, capped with dense foliage that cast the groves beneath the placid twilight. One of the defining features of old growth is the lack of understory. Smaller plants robbed of the sunlight by the canopy above. This means that you can see much further than you could in a different forest, where brush and vines might block your view. In the old growth ahead of me, I could see deep into the canopy shaded woods, darkness enveloping the trees that grew in twisted and gnarled shapes. Ancient beings shaped by countless years into warped and beautiful lines. I was nearly overtaken by the sight, a view so few people are able to look upon in this modern age. Even though I was nearly shaking with excitement to explore the acre's large stand of forest ahead of me, I knew that daylight would not last much longer. I would have to push off starting my work until the next day, working quickly to pitch my tent and create a small stone ring to act as a fire pit, before nightfall overtook my new campsite. The first night on the edge of the old-growth forest was so quiet, as I lay tightly wrapped in my sleeping bag, staring up through the vent net in the roof of my tent toward the stars above. I heard almost none of the sounds one might expect from camping deep in the woods. No night birds called, no insects buzzed. The only sounds were the rushing of the wind through the leaves, and, once, a mournful sound of an owl hooting somewhere within the ancient grove beyond the camp. I sat there awake in eerie silence for nearly the entire night, partially perturbed by the quiet but mostly entranced by the beauty of the starlit sky filled with excitement for the day to come. I eventually drifted off to sleep around 2 a.m., At 5:30 in the morning, I was awoken by the electronic chirping of my watch alarm, signaling the start of my day. Groggily sitting up, I immediately regretted not forcing myself to sleep earlier, yanking the zipper of my tent flap and exposing myself to the chill morning air. I rose to a stoop and began to exit my tent. As my head left the tent, I stopped, frozen and staring. I was staring down the barrel of a pump-action shotgun, clutched in the hands of a middle-aged bearded man. He wore old flannel and denim, a stained old baseball cap over the mop of gray hair. His face was cracked and split by intricate wrinkles, the telltale aging endured by a man who had spent his life outdoors. His gray eyes squinted as he met my shocked gaze, lowering the gun. "Well, crap. I'm sorry, son. I didn't expect anybody." "What do you mean you didn't expect anybody?" I asked, anger boiling to the surface as the shock of surprise ebbed away. "You walked into a campsite at 5 a.m. Why wouldn't there be anybody here?" His gnarled face didn't change from its stony demeanor. "Look, boy, I said I was sorry. No harm, no foul, right?" He shrugged nonchalantly, irritatingly dismissive of the fact that he had a loaded gun pointed between my eyes mere moments ago. He slung the weapon over his shoulder and extended a hand to help me out of my tent. Most tents you find up here are empty. It took a moment for what he had said to sink in. What do you mean? Like people come up here and dump their trashed old equipment? Disappointment began to brew as the thought of the old growth filled with trash entered my mind. Nah, son, nothing like that. Just exactly what I said. The tents you find up here are always empty. The name's Randy. Randy Davidson. This plot belonged to my grandpa, and his grandpa before him. His West Virginia drawl was thick and slow as he gestured toward the old growth stand. Before grandpa sold it to National Forest folks, eminent domain and whatnot. I furrowed my brow. Not only had I had the shock of my life less than a minute ago, now I was listening to the family history of some Appalachian backwater dude. My patience grew thin. So is that why you go around poking in other people's stuff? Scaring them when they wake up? For old time's sake? Randy squinted again, unimpressed with my impatience. Look, boy, all I'm gonna say is you better watch yourself out here in these woods. Grandpa used to tell stories. Was happy to have the feds take his land off his hands. Just pack up and leave is my advice. And with that, he turned and started walking away in the direction he came from. I stood there in uneasy silence and just watched him go. Was that a warning or a threat? And what could he have possibly meant about empty tents? His message had surprised and confused me as much as his sudden appearance in my camp. The early morning light grew brighter, and the mist that clung to the ground burned away as I gathered my things and prepared for my first foray into the old growth stand. I nearly inhaled my breakfast, excited to start my work. Then, pack filled and secured, I stepped beyond the edge of the grove. The old growth was breathtaking. Ancient trees surrounded me as I walked, dark twisting shapes disappearing into the shadowy canopy high above. No underbrush cluttered the ground, just stoic old boulders and thick sheets of soggy moss. The dense cover of leaves above cast the entire huge stand in the eerie pall of cool shade. The heavy earthy scent of loamy earth and wet woods filled my nose and lungs. Pristine silence filled the forest. I set to work immediately, invigorated by my utterly gorgeous surroundings. The noise I made was the only sound that echoed through the ancient woods around me, joining the quiet wind and leaves above. I identified species, measured trunk diameters, calculated height and slope, judged quality timber from trees best left standing. Dang, I thought to myself, almost all of these trees were worth thousands of dollars in timber as individuals. This stand of old growth alone would likely net the company over $1 million after harvest. How had this place not been logged yet? With a metallic rattle and aerosol hiss, I marked the trees that would be best harvested with my flagging paint. With the forest floor so clear of undergrowth, the bright orange X's I sprayed on the tree trunks could be seen in the distance in every direction, looming out of the darkness in their obviously unnatural neon hue. It felt strange to be painting this place, so long left beyond the reach of humanity. It was after 4 p.m. when I was finishing up the last sections of the stand I decided to work on today. There was a small, low valley near the center of the growth, edged by mossy boulders and muddy slopes. I had nearly finished marking the chosen trees in the valley when I came across something hauntingly strange. As I rounded the massive trunk of an old beautiful red oak, I saw it, sitting in the middle of a tiny clearing, shaded by dark leaves above, was the rusted hulk of an old RV. The paint was chipped and peeled away, almost to the point of non-existence, though there was still enough to make out the classic script of Winnebago. The tires were flat, sacks of rubber draped over rusted hubcaps. Moss grew over the windows of the abandoned vehicle. At least the glass hadn't been shattered and dropped away. The side door hung open on failing hinges, revealing nothing but inky darkness inside. I slowly approached the derelict, wet moss and leaves squelching under my boots. How did this thing get down here? There's no way it could have driven down these slopes of the valley, and there weren't any signs that it had fallen or crashed down there, besides the ravages of time. The old RV seemed undamaged. I stepped within a few feet of the Winnebago's open door. I fumbled through my backpack and produced my flashlight, noticing that the vehicle was ringed by a thick layer of heavy gray mud. Spurred by curiosity, I clicked my flashlight on and stepped on board the ruined RV through the broken door. As I did so, the eerie vehicle let out a wretched moan as a twisted spring shifted for the first time in what likely had been decades. I threw a glance back over my shoulder into the forest, suddenly feeling watched. All I noticed through the forest gloom were the neon orange X's I spray-painted on the trees, pointed at haphazard angles and particularly hidden by gnarled trunks. The interior of the RV was dark as night, even with the gloomy daylight filtering through the small sections of broken windows. The stark white beam of my flashlight cut through the darkness, a circle of vision too small for comfort. Something felt off the moment I was inside. The cabin of the vehicle was almost empty. Driver and passenger seats devoured down to metal frames by generations of vermin. Crusty lichen encased the steering column. The cup holders held two metal thermoses. The words, "Number One Dad" and "Number One Mom," just barely visible through the years of sylvan filth that had accumulated upon them. I turned my face to the main living space of the old wreck. Silence thick on the air, and only cut through by the creaks of the moldering floor beneath me. The built-in couch here had also suffered the same fate as the cabin seats, devoured by rats and insects searching for a nest. Cupboards hung open near the low ceiling, cardboard boxes of food within, reduced to pulp and slurry by years of exposure. I shone my needle of light across the room, noticing the narrow door at the rear. It hung barely ajar, a crack of darkness presumably leading to the RV's bedroom. As I stepped closer, a stench of mildew and wet dirt grew almost overpowering. With a groan of rusty hinges, I pushed the door open. My body ran cold as my flashlight beam settled on what waited beyond the doorway. Shocked, my breaths came quick and shallow as I took in the sight. The room held a bed, mattress and blankets untouched by foraging pests, but stained a deep black brown by mold and who knows what else. Upon the bed was a heap of clothing, gathered from a suitcase haphazardly left to rot on the floor around the bed. The clothes were stained the same shade as the foul mattress. I could make out at least four distinct sizes of clothing in the pile, two adults and two children. The stink of rotting vegetation was unimaginable. My hands shook, bobbing my light as they did so. As I gazed at the top of the pile, atop the wet heap of moldy old clothing was a dripping carcass of a deer, broken and twisted at unnatural angles to allow the decaying thing to be propped up in a pose like a man sitting cross-legged. Its head was bowed towards me, what was left of the meat blackened by rot. Its eyes had long since gone, leaving empty black sockets to stare into the dark. The cluster of mossy and scattered bones by the headboard revealed that this was merely the most recent animal left there, the next in a long line of deer propped up in this mess. Despite the dribbling animal wreckage before me, there was no smell of rotting, just the only wretched and overpowering odor of composting vegetation and decomposing fungus. Acrid vomit filled my sinuses, and I bolted to the door behind me. As I stuck my head and shoulders outside and prepared to retch, my eyes laid upon fresh horror. The bright orange of my marking paint sprayed at haphazard and dissonant angles as I had wandered the valley, all faced towards me in uniform stares. Every X I had painted down there looked towards me, neon color cutting through the forest gloom like electric eyes. The remainder of the food left my stomach, replaced by ice water as I lurched forward and vomited messily upon the mossy ground. Leaning from inside the RV, body shaking with confusion and terror, I wiped the tears from my eyes. The smell of rotting wood still clogged my nostrils. I stared at the splatter of fresh vomit below me, attempting to comprehend what I was looking at. The steamy bile was collecting in a footprint of the sticky gray mud. My shaky breath rattled in my lungs as I stared. It was unmistakable. Fresh tracks in the mud that surrounded the RV. a complete circle that stalked around the vehicle. They were deep, pressed into the muck by something big and heavy. The track took on a shape of a half-human foot, the long toes and forefoot evident like the tracks of someone walking barefoot and tiptoeing. What? Even the partial footprints were bigger than the tracks I had left. How had something so large moved so quietly around the RV? I hadn't heard a thing from inside. I rose to trembling feet and took a cautious step outside. The old growth was utterly silent beyond my nervous panting. The bright orange X's still stared in my direction. Not one where I had originally placed it. Crap, I thought to myself. I stood, scanning the empty forest floor and listening for any sounds to pierce the quiet. Seconds passed, feeling like an eternity, and then I bolted. Fear pounded in my ears as I sprinted through the forest, never once slowing as I made for camp. The feeling of a cold, calculating look from unseen eyes never left my back as I ran. I skidded into my tiny camp on the edge of the stand as the sun began to dim in the darkening sky, nearly collapsing with exhaustion as the daylight that filtered through the trees above began to decay. As I panted and gasped with exertion, I surveyed my surroundings, my tent and fire ring appearing untouched since I left this morning. As dusk settled over the forest, my surroundings began to darken. It wouldn't be long until they were black as the old growth at my back. There was no way I could leave tonight. Even if I wasn't petrified to be out in the dark, there wasn't any chance I could find my way back to Piper through the dark and unfamiliar woods. My mind raced as daylight failed around me. Do I set a fire and hope light and flames keeps whatever is out there at bay? Or do I sit in the darkness and pray I stay hidden in the shadowy and silent camp? There was no good options. I tensed up as I fought panic from setting in. Eventually, the primal instincts of my cave-dwelling ancestors kicked in. Fire was the one tool that always served our kind against darkness and the things that lurked within it. I piled all of my firewood into the ring. I wouldn't need it for another night. And as the night fell, the glowing light of my bonfire lit the forest around me, faltering at the edge of the old growth, my camp surrounded in firelight. I climbed inside my tent and sealed the zipper shut. I sat silently inside the thin nylon shell for hours, listening as the wind made the only sound beyond the crackling of the fire, which glowed through the walls of the tent. My hands shook and my spine prickled with nerves. My teeth chattered despite the humid heat that clung to me, sweat dripping from my brow. I moved slowly to check my watch. 3:30 a.m., less than 2 hours until I could flee this place. I jolted as a sudden snap shattered the silence. The sharp cracking noise emanated not 20 feet from my tent and followed by staccato rustling before sudden silence. My eyes were wide. The quiet, nearly imperceptible rustling came again. Whatever was outside was still there. I slowly grasped the zipper and pulled it with my left hand, while fumbling about with my right hand until it came to rest upon my pocket knife. It was a feeble little thing, but as a gift from my dad, it has always found its way into my pack. With my little blade clutched tight, I opened the door of my tent, slowly to keep the zipper quiet. I crept out into the night, the chilled air shockingly cold as it connected with my overheated and clammy skin. The bonfire still burned, though it had run low as the night dragged on. Silently surveying the camp before me, I searched for the source of the hushed sound. Slowly, my eyes was drawn upwards toward the boughs of the trees. Two eyes reflected in the firelight staring back at me. Shock gripped my heart, and it took all of my willpower not to exclaim with fear and surprise. The eyes went to the side, as if judging me. With more quiet rustles, the owl shifted on its branch, close enough to the firelight to reveal its identity. Relief flooded my body as I let out a quiet sigh. Then, true terror took over me as I noticed a huge shape in my peripheral vision. I slowly turned my head, tears welling up in my eyes. It sat waiting on its hunches, barely 6 feet away from me, dimly lit by the embers of the slowly dying fire. At first, I thought it was a huge man, a giant living in the woods. But this thing was no human. Never could have been. It sat, nearly curled in a fetal ball, long arms clasped to scrawny legs, and shoulders hunched. Its humanoid form was covered in greasy, pale skin stretched, taut over knobby bones and joints. The thing's elongated arms and legs were triple-jointed, digital-grade like the hind legs of a malnourished hairless goat. Its arms ended in hands, each bearing six long, twitching fingers, tipped with ragged and blackened nails. Its legs terminated in feet that may have been human, if they were not twisted and deformed, to allow the thing to walk its mud and filth-caked toes. It carried an unbearable stench of fungus and compost, but most horrible of all was its face. Atop its neck rested its gaunt head, oily and pale skin reflecting the guttering flames in the fire pit. Its nose and chin were hideously long and crooked, not unlike the jagged and pointed figures stereotypical of ancient witches. Its mouth was wide, pulled back to reveal black gums and long, blunt teeth that looked as if they had been taken from a human jaw and stretched cartoonishly to fit. Though it had no eyes, it stared intently at the owl in the tree. The twisted and hulking creature crouched beside me and slowly turned its head to face me. Barely visible, white orbs rolled and twitched in sunken eye sockets. The thing stared silently at me before raising a single finger to its drooling teeth. It let out a quiet, gurgling breath. Shh. Panic set my body ablaze. I scrambled to my feet, dropping my tiny pocket knife in the mud. The owl let out a shrieking protest as it took fight, spooked by the sudden movement. As I stumbled backwards, starting my sprint into the pitch-black forest, the thing rose to its feet on its tri-jointed legs. The thing had to have been at least 7 feet tall, but moved without making a sound. As I turned, it let out a hideous, gasping screech, a sound laden with ancient hate. I didn't look back, dashing through the underbrush, away from the old growth, and leaving the empty tent to join the others Randy had found. I don't know if it followed me. It was so big, but it moved so silently. As I ran, I didn't see it, didn't hear it, but the feeling of its look never left me. I ran blindly in the dark, whipping branches and bramble thorns at my face and hands. Sweat drenched me, pooling in my hiking boots. I didn't know how long I ran. At some point, I must have collapsed with exhaustion, blacking out in the depths of the forest. I woke up in the glaring shine of daylight, filtering down onto my face through the trees. My face and hands were caked with dirt. Two of my fingers were at least dislocated. Rising on shaky legs, I began my blind trek into the unfamiliar woods around me, hopelessly lost. I walked for hours, likely wandering in circles. My face and hands ached with a dull, pulsing pain. My skin itched and burned underneath. Finally, I stumbled upon the forest trail, old and ill-maintained. I couldn't believe my luck. I had resigned myself to being lost, being alone and hunted, deep in the unsettled Appalachia. Tears welled up as I hurriedly limped down the path, and I nearly shouted with elation when Piper came into view. Fumbling my keys, I managed to unlock her and climb inside, slamming and locking the door behind me. As I fired the ignition and the truck started up, the burning on my torso intensified, an awful itching sensation. Grimacing, I quickly set to see what the cause of my discomfort was. As I did so, a subtle stench of old vegetation began wafting into my truck. I felt cold eyes staring from the fringes of the woods. I pulled my jacket open, and the source of the itch, across my torso, spray-painted there with marker paint, was a bright orange X. The day I had been dreading finally came. After months of denied reports, quiet but heated arguments behind my boss's closed door, and the most intense procrastination ever known to man, the company sent me back to the old growth. You have to believe me, I fought it. But in the end, my protests were less than useless. I would have quit this job if I could, but I have bills to pay, fees to keep my parents cared for at their old age. There was nowhere to hide. The neon orange marker paint that I had discovered sprayed onto the Forester's X upon my torso had washed away easily enough, but it had left behind an angry red rash of scaly skin. The doctor told me that it was likely an allergic reaction to a chemical propellant in the aerosol, or a component of the paint itself. The itching rash had faded over time, but never fully disappeared. The faintest ghosts of the mark that haunted me, just barely visible to those who cared to look close enough. I had completed one or two assignments since the experience I previously recounted for you all, working in Pennsylvania and around D.C., to mark up and measure tiny stands of trees just outside the bustling suburban corridors. Even in those minuscule groves of adolescent trees and shrubs, the green grow of the canopy sent shivers down my spine. I was a wreck in nearly every sense of the word, and I don't think anyone who believed me could blame me. The problem was that no one actually did believe me, not truly. The email from the company heads came on March 2nd, 2020. When I saw it in my inbox, I sat silently staring in my cubicle for agonizing minutes, before finally resigning myself to cold acceptance. I scanned the details with defeat. Return to parcel. Monongahela National Forest. Work imperative. Multi-million dollar stake. Depart immediately. The rest of that morning is just a foggy blur, dragging myself through duties in preparation to return to the place where I had encountered something I could not explain. Something I could not forget. It must have been just before noon when Piper and I were roaring down the interstate towards the dreaded grove. Acres of black woods and hidden things. I shouldn't have gone. I have no recollection of the 4-hour drive into the depths of West Virginia. The next thing I knew, I was standing next to my truck, engine clicking and popping as it cooled and settled, with my heavy pack slung over my shoulders. Ahead of me loomed a narrow trailhead that led to a forest the world had forgotten. With a shuddering breath, I steeled myself and stepped into the woods. The sensation was so strange. My mind was caught in a vicious wrestling match between feelings of terror and the comfort of coming home. I absent-mindedly pawed at the faded mark under my jacket as I tramped along the winding and undergrown path. Thoughts churned and changed with my aching mind. The things I had seen here, half remembered and half unforgettable. The splendor of the unspoiled forest around me, grinning, teeth. The endless awe of the old growth. I walked in a daze like man towards the gallows, or perhaps towards a holy reliquary. By the time I walked around the old sycamore tree, just a few scant bones left lashing in its branches, I had regained my senses. The sights and sounds of the woods returned to me as I made it towards the old campsite. I wiped away the watery stuff running from my nose. It was just cold out here. Only the first buds of the year starting to appear on the branches of the trees. This was about the time I began cursing to myself for coming back out here. But it was far too late now. Suddenly, I stepped out into the tiny clearing in which I had once made camp. On the far end of the break in the woods waited the boundary of old growth, looming ancient trees cast in a shade of dark, old leaves that still clung to their storing branches, in stark refusal to let the sunlight desecrate the floor of the grove. Even in the latest days of winter and the earliest days of spring, shadow ruled the old growth waiting ahead. As I stared, a chill wind whispered from between the tree trunks, stinging my face and whipping through the air. A grim thought crawled through my mind. Yeah, hello to you too. Pulling my gaze from the dark boundary ahead of me, I surveyed the small clearing. The ground was sodden and muddy with snowmelt. The detritus of water was fading away with the season. The shredded remnants of my old tent stood in half-hearted defiance of gravity, poles bent and broken in angles, better suited to modern art. Slowly pulling open the door flap of the mostly collapsed tent, I saw that all of the original contents were missing. My sleeping bag and backpack I had carried out here previously, nowhere to be seen. I just let the tent flap fall back. There was no salvaging the nylon heap. Just as Randy, The local who had accosted me the last time I was here had said, "The tents you find here are always empty." I turn around to check the fire pit, less than a dozen feet behind me. The stones were still there, but not as I had left them. The rounded forest stones, now covered in crawling moss and flaking lichen. They were stacked in a perfect tower that came up to stomach height, one on top of the other. They were balanced immaculately. The slightest breeze should have been enough to upset the delicate cairn, but the stones did not fall. Atop of the tower of stones, untouched by vegetation, age, or weather, was my pocket knife, dropped in the shock of my previous encounter here. With a spiteful sniff, I snatched the knife and gave the stones a small kick, letting the tower crumble to a pile. I made camp in the clearing over the next hour or so, pitching my new tent and reconstructing the fire ring. I unfurled a large ball of twine I had brought with me, attached aluminum cans to it as I laid a tripwire perimeter around my little oasis. Setting an alarm like this would do little to help me should anything go wrong during my stay here, but it eased my worry just the same. Just as night fell, I sat by my fire, listening to the silence of forest that I knew all too well. I awoke in my tent in the early morning rays of the sunlight to the buzzing sound of my watch, letting me know it was time to work. I went through my morning routine, had my breakfast, threw my backpack on, stepped over my trap wire, and marched as stoically as I could to muster across the clearing towards the waiting old growth. As I quietly stepped across the mossy floor of the darkened grove, I noticed one thing. My work was gone. All of the bright orange X's I had marked upon the trees that were meant to be harvested had disappeared like the mist in the wind. That paint was designed to last as long as the logging projects may drag on, sometimes years, and I had sprayed it here merely 6 months ago, and now it was all gone. The bark of the trees, barren of paint and gnarled and blackened by hundreds of years, mocked me. Gritting my teeth, I began to work. I toiled for hours that day in the chilly March weather, the ancient forest around me silent beyond the sounds of my work, measuring, mapping, marking. I went through my tasks quickly and robotically, never once shaking the undeniable sensation of cold eyes on my back. Maybe my fear made me more perceptive, or maybe the forest and what waited within, it simply chose to show me more than it ever had before. Whatever the case, I saw things. Rare sights that punctuated the hours within the stand. Animal bones lashed to and dangling from branches that towered over the muddy ground. A bright yellow hunter's cap, soaked with water and stuffed into a gap between boulders. The rusted lower frame and wheels of an old-fashioned baby carriage. A tangled pile of twine and aluminum cans, new and untouched by age or weather. There was less than an hour of daylight left as I finished my first day of work. I rounded the thick trunk of a massive honey locust. Stinging odor of the marker paint was still wafting from the fresh X I had marked there. Beyond the old tree was a steep forest pothole, perhaps a sinkhole that had collapsed thousands of years ago. It had dropped merely 5 feet down and maybe 10 feet across. Drawn by some human curiosity, I peered over the edge. The sides of the shallow pit were choked thick with roots and sheets of moss, creating a coiled mass of wet vegetation that stacked downwards, dangling into the murky foot and half-rainwater and snowmelt that collected at the bottom of the wide hole. The smell of stagnant water and something far worse rose up to meet my nose, causing me to recoil at the stench. A shiver ran down my spine as I looked upon what floated in a pit below. Fur matted in oozing mud and rotting mold clung to bloated meat. The extremities revealed the darkened and spongy remnants, soaked through with the stinking and stagnant water that filled the pool. The horrid thing had at one point been a large dog, perhaps a German shepherd, judging by the patches of fur. Strapped across the dog was an old backpack I had left behind the first time I came to the old growth. The sharp sound of a snapping twig came from behind me, and I whirled to face the noise, sudden shock gripping my racing heart. The man stood there, wrinkled and weather-beaten face below a stained old cap. I recognized Randy Davidson a split second before he spoke. Well, I'll be gone, he drawled, recognition sparking in his eyes, as gray as his hair. The remnants of the old rash on my torso twitched dully. It's you again. What are you doing back out? His question was suddenly cut short as a massive pale shape lunged from the growing shadows around us. The hulking white thing moved soundlessly as it took Randy into the muddy ground. He let out a gasp as the air was knocked out of him. With inhuman speed, it whipped around to face me, and my existence ran cold as I laid eyes on its all-too-familiar grin and greasy flesh. The stench of the rotting moss wafted over me. Pale orbs twitched in their membrane-covered sockets as the horror struck in me. A single, triple-jointed arm reaching out and bashing into my torso. The thing hit with the strength of a feral beast, bolts of pain shooting through my torso. The lightning-fast strike sent me skidding and stumbling backwards, the feeling of weightlessness overtaking me as I tumbled into the pit at my back. I was still attempting to get air in response to the creature's strike when I hit water, stinking liquid rushing in. I had landed almost directly onto the dog. I lurched upwards out of the shallow pool, alternatively gasping for air. Adrenaline roared in my ears. I could hear the sounds of struggle above, crashing branches and spattering mud accompanied by Randy's voice of terror. I scabbed at the slick moss and roots around me, attempting to haul myself out the short distance of the sinking pit. Slipping on wet vegetation and collapsing mud, I managed to drag my shoulders above the edge of the sinkhole. I saw Randy struggling against the pale thing that stalked the old growth, pinned to the ground with its hooked nose mere inches from his face. I watched in horror as the thing craned its neck downwards with an almost serpentine sway, joints creaking as it did so. It parted its long, blunted teeth. His screams were muffled as the thing leaned in. They held there struggling as I hauled myself out of the pit. Then it craned backwards, turning its face to meet my terrified stare. Randy had a breath, its teeth clenched in a disgusting mockery of a grin. I sat up on all fours at the edge of the pit as it released Randy, spectral grace bellying its monstrous size as it rose to its full, towering height. Joints and tendons creaked within its gaunt self as it took slow and purposeful steps towards my prone form. A deep, cloaking click slowly emanated from the depths of it as it reached towards me with its black fingernails. When all of a sudden I was yanked to my feet and dragged to the side, it was Randy, coughing as he pulled my jacket collar. "Come on and run," he gasped, not letting go of me as he began sprinting into the woods that surrounded us. I pumped my legs to keep up, the speed of terror propelling me. We dove through the old growth, ancient trees seeming to twist around us in the growing darkness. Mud clotted our boots and threatened to pull us into the ground with every step we took. I followed Randy, hoping he had a destination, and was not simply running into the woods in a panic. Looking over my shoulder, I could not see the thing following us, but I could hear it somewhere in the gloom as it laughed and called. Noises, like the hellish fusion of a squealing pig and a cackling lunatic. I don't know how long we fled into the darkening night. The sun had disappeared completely by the time we stopped, panting for breath and nervously eyeing the woods around us. Randy kneeled over with his hands on his knees and waved a finger past me. I turned to check what he was pointing at and saw a dark shape looming out of the darkness, the blocky bulk of a lightless cabin. I helped Randy towards the structure as he fumbled around in his pocket, producing and jangling a heavy-laden keyring. He seemed sluggish, as if the run had taken a steep toll on him. We crossed the creaking porch with haste. The cabin was a plain thing of log timbers, beaten and drained by weather and age until they were desiccated and gray. I stared grimly at the wooden door, which bore a crude and obviously recent carving of an X. Randy put an old-fashioned iron key into the lock and pushed the door open, hurrying inside. I followed. Randy fumbled ahead of me in the darkness, rattling objects which I could not see. I heard the telltale sign of laughter followed by a flash of flint. Then, after a few seconds, the flickering glow of a tiny fire set dancing illumination to weakly fill the space around us. The cabin was tiny, one room of maybe 15 feet on each side. A small cast-iron stove, caked beyond usefulness by thick layers of rust, with an old pile of firewood at its side, stood to my right. Directly ahead was a square table on which rest an eclectic gathering of woodworking tools and dining utensils in a haphazard stacks, as well as the flickering candle that Randy had lit. Two stools waited, tucked underneath the table's edge. At the back of the room was a simple bed, sheets stretched across the lumpy mattress, almost entirely eaten by moths and mice. Small glass-painted windows glinted in the candlelight. Everything was drenched in dust and a smell of mildew, obviously untouched for years. Randy lurched past me, slamming the door shut and ramming the lock closed. As he moved close to me, I could smell foul sweat rolling down his pores. "Help me lock the shutters," he said. I moved to oblige him, pulling the heavy wooden shutters over the small windows and looping the hook locks closed. He talked quietly as he worked to close the windows on the other side of the cabin. "Great-grandpa's hunting cabin. Came out here once or twice when I was a kid with my old man to check on the property after my grandpa sold it off." He paused to expel a hacking cough. "Lucky I even remembered where it was." I glanced over my shoulder as I moved to the final window on my side of the room. "Randy, what is this thing?" "Your guess is as good as mine. I ain't never seen anything like it before in my life." I heard him take a shaky breath. "My granddad used to say something wasn't right about these woods. Would tell us things. My old man would spin them off for spinning ghost stories." "Well, what do we do now?" "I never should have come back." The hinges creaked as I forced the shutters against the window. "Yeah, maybe you shouldn't have." Randy trailed off as he struggled with his own window behind me. "Randy?" I probed as silence began to grow. As I slowly turned to see the cause of the quiet, a foul sound and stench got to my senses. A wet, rumbling expulsion of gas and a vicious spattering upon the ground, and the burning odor of sickness, sulfur, brought stinging tears to my eyes. "What? Randy? Are you kidding me?" The angry words stopped as I whirled around to face him. Randy stood facing me, shivering in place. His face, gaunt and pale, streamed with sweat and tears, which ran down and pooled in his deep wrinkles of his skin. Dark circles, the deep purple of an old bruise, had formed under his eyes, which stared blankly ahead. His nose dribbled with spit and mucus. Randy whispered in a quiet, "Well, dang." Before going to the ground, sliding down the old timbers to lay against the cabin wall. Fighting back panic, I rushed to his side. He rolled his head weakly to face me. "Oh my, Randy, what's happening?" I took his sweat-drenched hand in my own. "Granddad got sick like this. Came back from the woods one night. Came back like this." Randy let out a slow cough. "Nobody ever knew what happened. He didn't even make it through the night. That it had got him. Nobody knew what he was talking about. Help me." As he spoke, the boards of the cabin porch let out a creak. Randy let out a noise. "Oh no, please." He stared at me with begging eyes toward me. "Please, get me." The X-shaped rash on my torso felt as if it were on fire. Slow taunting scratching rattled along the floor. With his free hand, Randy at my side. His face was a shattered mosaic of pain and strenuous effort, drenched in sweat of sickness. With a weak sound, he brought his head up, clutched his pale and shaking fingers with my pocket knife, the one my dad had given me long ago. He pressed and folded the blade into my hand. "Please don't let me go like my grandpa did," he softly begged. The door at my back groaned as slow, even pressure was applied. Randy's sorrowful, cloudy eyes stared at me. My torso was a stinging matrix of pain. I held my breath as I stared at the little implement in my hand, then back at Randy. There was a sharp pop and a clatter as the lock snapped and fell to the floor behind me. He gasped for a final moment before falling silent, further slumping soundlessly. I kneeled there sobbing as the floorboards behind me creaked with a heavy weight. A click emanated directly from above me. I closed my eyes. A heavy hand came to rest on top of my head. Inhumanly long fingers stroking my face. I sat immobile as creaking joints moved above me. More deep chittering. The sound of dragging and a heavy thump. The hand left my head. The sounds and creaking floorboards retreated towards the door, and then were replaced by the cracking of something dragging across the forest floor, deeper into the old growth. I sat in the cabin, eyes tightly shut, until weak rays of sunlight warmed my back through the open doorway. I opened my aching eyelids. Randy was gone. He was pulled away, leaving behind a dark trail which disappeared into the woods. I rose to shaking feet. Mindlessly, I wandered the old growth. I trudged, unfeeling and unthinking. I must have stumbled circles around the forest for hours. In the end, I found myself staring at my truck, my fateful old Piper, through bleary eyes. On the stark white paint of her hood, smeared, was a huge Forester's X. A squealing cackle echoed somewhere in the distance of the woods. Where the lines crossed in the center of the hood, rest my pocket knife, clean and folded. The world has all but forgotten the old growth, but I never will.
I had just turned 15, and it was the end of the summer. My parents were working. They were administrative and monetary consultants, and my brother was in basketball practice, so I was home alone with my puppy while watching TV. The phone rang. I said, "Hello?" A feminine voice answered and said, "Hello? Are you Martha's son?" Yes. My name is OP. Who asks? "Oh, it's Janice. Your mom and I have been working together for 5 years. I have never seen or heard Janice. My parents have always kept their jobs and personal lives miles apart, but I knew who she was. My mom always spoke about her. She was the personal assistant of one of the owners." "Oh, Janice? My mom's not here right now. What can I help you with?" "Oh, I'm sorry, but Mr. Delgado called me. Your mom and dad are in court. They seem to be in trouble. And he is just arriving there. A fraud allegation, he said. They can't call due to the legal proceedings, but can I have your cell phone number? Mr. Delgado will call you right away, so he can explain better." "Yeah, sure. My number is 123-456-789. "Don't worry, I'm sure it's nothing serious. Take care." And she ended the call. Don't worry. I was scared. My mom and dad would never commit a crime. Or I didn't think so. Maybe this was a misunderstanding. Before I continue, I must clarify some things. Mr. Delgado was another name I knew, this time thanks to my dad. He was a junior associate in the same place my parents and Janice worked. And as far as my parents' conversation went, he was a very capable lawyer. My cell phone rang. It was a male voice. "Hello, is this OP?" "Yeah, Mr. Delgado?" "Yeah, kid, listen to me. We are in quite the trouble. I'm here in the court. Your parents are being prosecuted for tax evasion and financial fraud. I am working with bare minimum here, and the judge won't let me talk to them, so I need your help. This is a thunder case, so if we don't work fast, we could be in serious problems." "What? But my parents would never do anything like that. We haven't done anything illegal." "OP, I believe you. I know you are scared, but listen to me. I need your help so you can help Mom and Dad, all right?" Almost crying, I said, "I will try. Have your parents made some really big purchases recently? Property, a car maybe, house items like a TV, computer, fridges, anything like that? Anything that could set the government alarms about illegal money movement?" "Well, my dad bought me a computer for my birthday, and my brother got a new iPad. He may have used my dad's credit card." "Oh, that's great. That could be part of it. Anything else?" "Not that I can remember. Maybe they just took an extra large sum of cash from the bank. Do you have access to the safe? Your dad said you have one." "Safe? We don't have a safe. Not one that I'm aware of. I don't know what you're talking about." "Darn, I thought he told you about it. Maybe it's because you're too young. Your brother didn't know either." "Have you talked to Josh? I was going to call him, but he rarely answers when he's playing." "Yeah, Janice spoke to him before calling you. OP, you can't call your brother nor your parents. These kind of procedures are very sketchy. Your parents' cell phones are held by the police, and I'm sure they are going to track calls. They won't track mine or Janice's because we're their lawyers, but yours are not safe. So please answer only if it's just the two of us. Janice's number is this, and this is mine. Understand? Yes, sir. Okay, I'll call you later. Take care. He hung up. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. Couldn't call anyone. And I just found out my dad was keeping a secret safe from me. What the heck? Since when did my parents manage that kind of money? I waited for an hour. I was just about to call Mr. Delgado when I received a call. The number was Janice. OP, sweetie, how are you? I'm fine. Oh, baby, don't cry. We're going to solve this together. I know this is going to end well. Mr. Delgado was able to speak with your dad, Philip, and they had made a deal with the prosecution. They're going to do a home check to see if there's not any stolen or fraudulent assets, and all of this will be over. Oh, okay, that's amazing, Janice. I know, but that brings us another problem. These break-ins are sometimes done by crooked people, and they will take anything they consider valuable as evidence, and will never return it. Your mother fears they will do that, especially to her jewelry, and most importantly, her wedding ring. You need to take it all out, including the computers. We already told the judge about them, and he discarded them as the case. But we don't know if the agents will respect that verdict. Mr. Delgado is going to pick the things up. I said, but wait. I don't know where my mom keeps her jewels or her wedding ring. Janice said, they must be in her room. Just look for those you can save. Worry about those that could look suspicious. Okay, but does Mr. Delgado know where I live? Yes, sweetie. He will wait for you in the park on the other side of the street. Be ready in 30 minutes. She hung up, and I did what I was told. I went to my house, searching for anything that looked expensive, and put it in my backpack. I was able to find Mom's ring and other gold jewels. I also packed my brother's laptop and my old computer. Better be safe, I thought. I went to the park and I waited. Mere minutes later, a black SUV made a turn and parked in the other side. A bald man in a suit came out and made signs. When I came close, about 3/4 of the distance between us, my survival instinct finally kicked off. I said, Mr. Delgado? Yes, boy, it's me. That voice on the cell phone, no doubt about that. But there was something off. Mr. Delgado was a junior associate, and my father always said how he was an intelligent young man that would go very far. The guy in front of me was at least in his 40s, not young at all. I stopped, so the man came closer. He said, is there a problem? Are you all right? His fatherly tone was almost enough to put my guards down, almost. No, I'm fine. Well then, let's go. Your parents are waiting. Sorry, what? Where are we going? To court, obviously. You can't be here when the police does the checkup. The alarm has gone off in my head and its volume was just increasing. In that moment, I finally started putting pieces together. Mistakes in their story, some illogical points they have made. This was wrong. There was something wrong in here. I needed to get away from there as fast as I could, but there was a problem. Mr. Delgado had company. I could see in the SUV there was another man in the driving place. The park was totally empty, and my house was not too far away for a sprint. No one in the streets either. I was alone, until I remembered I was not. Mr. Delgado looked at me very suspiciously, like he knew something had changed. Kid, let's go. I said, oh, my puppy. What? I can't leave my puppy alone. He's just a few months old. But I need to go for him. It's important. We don't have time for the dog. I was making time. I needed him to believe I was still in this game until someone arrived in the area. It was still a public park in summer. It was bound to happen sooner or later, more likely sooner. I think he knew the same. Whoever he was, he knew he couldn't stay long in the open. Fine. Go for the puppy, but give me the backpack. It looks heavy. It will only make you slower. I didn't want to give it to him, but I did. It would at least appease him somehow. If I refused, who knows what he could do. And I went away. I didn't run. I just walked, trying to keep the charade, until I was sure the distance between us was enough. And I speed up. Never have I ran that fast. I didn't know it was possible for me to go that fast. As I was getting farther, I could hear the SUV engine as it started and went its way. I stopped. I was in front of my house. and broke apart. I was crying. I shouted, scared, sad, mad. How could I be that stupid? My neighbor heard me and came at that moment. She must have thought I was having a panic attack. Well, maybe I was, and she hugged me, trying to calm me down. I told her everything, and she was the one who called my mom. My mom was at her house in 15 minutes after that and hugged me so tight, I was still terrified, and it would still be a long time after the incident. And I still would be, even for a long time after that incident. To this day, I'm unable to answer a phone call of an unknown number without feeling a pain in my stomach. And in general, I hate phone calls. Only text is what I say to everyone I meet. I gave away the equivalent of $5,000 in electronics, jewels, and some spare cash I had found. I gave away my mom's wedding ring and two family heirlooms. I gave away my birthday present and the iPad my brother had spent all year saving for. In that moment, I just hated myself. I hated that I was tricked so easily. Even if my family said the most important thing was that I wasn't hurt, I still saw the pain on losing all the material things, especially mom, that hurt me the most. With time, we were able to understand that this was a very long game we have been involved for months. How did they know my parents' co-workers' names and jobs? My mom lost a flash drive with lots of documents some weeks prior. She believes on the bus with a lot of job information. Nothing legal, mostly administrative. It is also likely that they got our home telephone from one of those documents. How did they know where we lived? That summer we had received a lot of calls from different services. Ex-bank, ex-cell phone line, ex-public service to verify data. Most of the time it was my brother who answered, sometimes my mom or me. We understood that under the pretext, they were able to obtain not only our address, but they verified my parents' name. How did they know I was alone so they could trick me? Same method, with their almost daily calls. They knew who was at home and what time, and were able to pinpoint that most Tuesdays and Thursdays, I was left in the house with nobody else, not even my brother. I also believe they had come to the area at some time, as they knew the park had no security cameras, and that my mom did not use her ring. They created this whole story, almost perfect, but it still had flaws. First, the one that saved me, Mr. Delgado's age. Second, I forgot my mother had just been working in the Buffett for 3 years. It was impossible she met Janice 5 years prior. Third, the safe thing. Obviously a general assumption, they may believe every person has one. Fourth, I found weird Mr. Delgado was acting as my parents' lawyer when my uncle, my dad's brother, had always been the one in charge of small legal problems that we had. And fifth, all of their legal chit-chat. I didn't really know our legal system that well, but it's almost impossible that you're taken suddenly to court and judged in less than a day without being able to establish a defense. This is just what I can remember. As this was almost 12 years ago, my conversations with Janice and Mr. Delgado were longer, and I know I had seen more holes in their story once I reviewed them without panic. Sadly, I saw through their lies too late, and when I was already in a very bad position. I was a victim of the millionaire call, a method in which criminals manipulate the most naive and vulnerable people in a household, using an emotional bargain so that they will willingly give up their things or even themselves. The thieves were never caught. The phones they used were fake ones, and without camera footage, the police had nothing to work with. There were no fingerprints or similar because they didn't touch anything that I kept. I was not able to see the SUV plate due to the distance, and Mr. Delgado was an average guy without any identifiable marks. The only good thing that happened that day was that I didn't enter their car. Maybe I won't be writing this if I did. We lived in fear that they would reappear someday, as they knew our address. But thank God it didn't happen, and I hope it stays that way. I have a few frightening stories to tell, but this one is playing out right now, so I thought I would share it with you. Last May, my husband, myself, and our two small boys left our farm in the country, and we moved into a posh, boutique-style urban apartment building. My husband had recently received a sizable raise after many years with his current company, and we wanted to be closer to his office and to mine. We chose this particular building as it was brand new and offered an array of shopping, eating, and outdoor amenities, without ever having to leave the building or surrounding shopping center. we quickly settled in and started enjoying the new change of pace. At first, everything was fine, but about 3 months into our lease, we noticed that the front office completely changed staff. We were upset about the change because two of the receptionists had been personal friends of ours. We asked them why everybody had been let go, but they said they didn't know why. Apparently, corporate had just decided they wanted a change. We were sad to see our friends go, especially our 2- and 3-year-old boys, who had grown quite fond of their daily visit to the office of milk and cookies. We also noticed that the new staff was mainly comprised of much younger, attractive women. We assumed then that the management company intended to appeal to the college crowd and singles. We were slightly annoyed with the general lack of experience and customer service, but thought that it wasn't the end of the world, and we moved on. Then weird stuff happened. One morning I walked into the living room to find our patio door wide open. It seemed odd because we triple locked it to keep the children from accessing the patio unsupervised. I locked the door and then accused my husband of being absent-minded and leaving it open. He swore that he hadn't touched the door or the locks in days, and I let it go but made a mental note to start checking it every night before bed, just in case. About 2 weeks later, I awoke to the sound of my oldest boy screaming for me somewhere outside of the apartment. When I found him, he was wandering the hallway outside, soaked in urine and utterly terrified. At the time, we were absolutely baffled at how he managed to unlock 2 locks and a childproof lock cover. When we asked him what happened, he said that a monster was in his room looking at him, and he didn't want to move, so he peed in the bed. Honestly, I was so happy he was safe that I just chalked it up to a kid imagination and my husband not locking the door properly again. It never crossed my mind that someone had potentially been inside the apartment and let him out. They would have had to open the door from the outside, and only we have a key. Weird stuff like that kept happening for several more months, and we kept finding reasonable excuses that explained everything away. But then one afternoon I got a call from the office of our apartment. We had recently installed a Ring doorbell to alert us when someone was at the door. It was mostly an attempt to prevent another runaway toddler. The woman from the office asked me if our door camera was operational or just put there to make people think that we had security. I informed her that it was 100% functional and that we installed video surveillance in our nursery and the adjoining bathroom to keep the kids safe. She then asked me a really weird question. She wanted to know if I would add her to our security devices so that she could view our Ring footage. Of course, I politely told her that that was not going to happen. I asked her why she wanted it, but never got a clear answer. I told my husband about the call later that night, and he agreed that we should make an effort to always keep the Ring charged and recording to the cloud. We did, and things seemed fine for a while. Over the course of our lease, the doors have continued to occasionally, magically, come unlocked and open, even locks that the kids can't reach, and it's always overnight, or we notice them when we get home from work. About 2 months ago, things started to go missing from the apartment. At first, it was little things like a new tube of mascara or a $20 bill left on the kitchen island. My husband and I thought it might be our baby storing them somewhere like treasures. He sometimes does that with my husband's golf balls, so it wasn't too far-fetched. But then bigger, more expensive items started to disappear. Our iPad vanished from my nightstand. A leather jacket with a designer label no longer hung from its hanger on the side of my closet. A bra, still with tags, went absent from one of my dresser drawers. And a full bottle of prescription painkillers was nowhere to be found. So was half of a bottle of my anxiety meds. We now began to suspect that something really weird was happening in our apartment, but had no proof. The nursery and bathroom cameras didn't show anything during the day, and we started making our boys sleep in bed with us at night. The bedroom door locked from the inside. I could swear that I woke up in the middle of the night, once to a slight thudding noise, and saw the shadows of movement on the other side of the door. But I fell back asleep before I could register what was happening. I take a Tylenol 3 most nights before bed, so while I do wake up at the slightest noise, staying awake is a battle of its own. This is our last month at these apartments. In 2 weeks, we'll be moving into our home. 2 weeks ago, I obtained a money order for the last month's rent. It was a large money order, and had to be halved in 2. As always, I brought it home, along with the receipt, and placed them in a magnetic sleeve attached to the freezer that also housed our monthly invoice. Now, I don't know how to fill out a money order. I know how stupid that is, but I never worried about it since my husband usually fills them out and pays our rent. It's not that I can't learn, but I'm lazy and don't mind letting him do that. That means that the money order and the rent sleeve was blank. And guess what? It too went missing. A novice mistake, I know. But thank God for online banking. One call to our bank and an investigation had begun. We waited with unease until this afternoon, when a representative from the company that had an issue with the money order gave us a call. The call was to inform us that the order had been cashed and that a thief was identified. Sure enough, it was one of the receptionists in our building, the same young woman who had called to ask about our new security devices. She had been using the spare maintenance key to come inside of our apartment whenever she wanted to. Tomorrow I will take this information to the building's manager. At the moment, we weren't pressing charges as long as our conditions are met. Hopefully this young lady gets help because we don't think she's malicious, just a thief and a grade A creeper. Don't worry, tonight will be our last night here. As far as her watching my children sleep goes, I can't say that I'll be comfortable having them sleep away from me for a good long while. I feel terrible for not believing my son. I tear up just thinking about how scared he must have been. The new house will get a full security system with every bell and whistle. We're still not sure how she got past the Ring camera without being seen, but my husband is dead set on figuring it out. An update to the story. When we got to the office this morning, the manager greeted us, apologized about 20 times, and informed us that said receptionist had been let go when she arrived on the property this morning. We made sure that he understood the gravity of the situation, especially concerning our children's safety and the fact that the building is mostly comprised of families and retirees. We came to an agreement not to pursue legal action against the company as long as we could leave today with our deposit in hand and never hear from them again. We also made him promise to send out a PSA to the other residents explaining portions of the situation in case she had been doing this to other people, which I would put money on that she did. We are currently throwing our belongings into boxes and laundry baskets, awaiting family and friends coming to help us move out. My husband and I decided not to pursue our missing property. However, we will be filing charges for the theft of the money order. We think she was leaving the patio doors unlocked because we have a first floor apartment with a sunroom, and she was unlocking them at night when we charged the Ring, so that she could let herself in during the day via the patio. It explains why we never got her on camera, and why she would be so bold as to come in at night while we were home asleep. My guess is that the night that our son got out, she had snuck in to unlock the back door and saw him awake. She must have waited until he was still for a while, and then ran back out the front door, forgetting to completely shut and lock it. When he finally felt safe enough to get out of the bed, he saw the lights from the hall and followed them, wanting to be out of the dark, where he saw the monster. This story was from around 5 years ago, give or take a few months. To set the stage, I was 19 and living in a very large city in the southern U.S., population nearly 2 million, and with several military installations. I was dating a guy at the time who was in the Army and stationed at the joint base nearest to where I was living at the time. I had a full-time job and also was in school, but all of my free time was spent with my boyfriend, and since he was in training at the time, he didn't have a car, so I was on and off that base constantly, and I had gotten to know the gate guards. I still had to present my visitor ID and pass every time because it was protocol, but they knew me. The base itself is huge, like its own little small town, in and of itself. Driving onto the base by accident is impossible. There are a few entrances, but I usually use the second biggest entrance. To get there, you had to drive down a 5-lane road, 2 lanes each way and 1 turning lane. As you approach, there's a huge golf course that's part of the base as well as our national cemetery, so there's huge fences and large signs stating that it's government property. And to the right is some businesses, restaurants, barbershops, dry cleaners, and gas stations, as well as a few residential neighborhoods with smaller side streets. But as you get closer to the gate, there's really nowhere to go except the base, unless you're going to the physical rehab center, senior living center. That's on the right, and literally the last place to turn in before you're going through the gates. The road leading into the base is really long, so as you go further away from the base on the same road, there's more businesses. more neighborhoods, apartments, and a Walmart, both approximately 3 to 5 miles, give or take, from the gate. I also happened to use this road when I was going straight from work to pick up my boyfriend, as there's an exit from the interstate and the most direct route. So I was just heading down the road. And one thing I'll note is that I'm a pretty careful driver, ever since I got into a terrible car accident with my mom when I was 12 and seriously injured. I drive a little faster than the speed limit, but not by much, and I always try to move out of the way for people going faster than me, because I know it can be annoying to be stuck driving behind somebody going slower than you, and just because I want to go slower doesn't mean I want to annoy other drivers by it. I was about 2 miles from base in the right-hand lane when I came up on somebody slowing down to take a turn. I checked my mirrors and flicked on my blinker and went to make a lane change to go around. There had been an old clunky blue van, like a Chevy Astro or something similar looking, in the left lane, but it was still pretty far back, and I was planning to move back to my lane anyways as soon as I passed the car in front of me. Well, Mr. Astro didn't like me getting into his lane when I was going slower than he was. Again, he was far enough back that if he maintained his speed, I would have been back over before he reached me. But no, I heard an engine rev, and all of a sudden this guy was right on my bumper, laying on his horn, making rude gestures. I've always been a rather meek and quiet person, and I hate confrontation, so I was going to pull back into the right lane to get back over once I passed the car in front of me. But by then it was another car in that lane trying to speed past everyone, so I couldn't move over immediately. As I waited for another car to pass, so I could move into the right lane, the Astro behind me is speeding up on my tail, and then backing off, just to speed up on my tail again. Other car passes and I move into the right lane so the Astro can pass me. He sped up and then slowed, so he was driving right next to my car. I glanced over and this older guy, with raggedy hair and a dirty ratty beard, just stared over at me, still making rude gestures. Then made a gun sign with his hand and pointed his fingers at me, miming shooting me in the head. This really freaked me out, but not as much as when he slowed down even further and got right behind me again. This road can be really trafficy during rush hours, but I'd gotten off of work early that day, around 3:45, so the traffic wasn't bad, and he definitely did not need to be behind me anymore, so there was so much room for him just to go around and leave behind me. Obviously freaked out, I tried to shake him. I changed lanes, he followed me, and I slowed down, and so did he. So I got back into the right lane, coming up on a light that just turned yellow, and made a risky, very quick right turn on that road, hoping he wouldn't be able to follow me. He apparently didn't care, and took the turn right after me. I remember looking into my rear view and seeing the van practically leaning on the turn, and he was still yelling, making hand gestures at me. I took some more turns and started weaving through a neighborhood trying to lose him, but he just kept following me. Finally, a moment of clarity hit me when I took a sharp turn, and my visitor's pass for base slid off of the front seat. I wove through the neighborhood until I got back to the road that we had been on, the one that leads straight into the base, and I booked it down the road with Mr. Astro right behind me. I saw him in my rear view as I pulled up to the gate, and was terrified to see him pull in behind me. I thought there was no way that this guy could follow me onto the base. At the time, they were an FPCON Bravo, which means no one could drive onto the base unless they had proper military staff or ID for a 30-day visitor pass and driver's license. But luckily I knew the guard at the gate. I pulled in and he could tell I was a bit frazzled because my hands were shaking as I handed him my ID and my pass. Before he could ask, I said, "The guy in the car behind me is very scary. He's been following me for 15 minutes making hand gestures and yelling. He made finger guns like he was going to shoot me." And the guard was very nice and smiled and nodded and acted like everything was okay. Didn't even glance back at the van. He told me, "Okay, don't worry about it. You're safe now, and this guy won't get anywhere near you. Is your boyfriend done for the day?" I said, "No, I don't think he's done till 4:30. I was just going to read in my car until he's done." He told me to go about with my plans, to head over to my boyfriend's barracks, and he and the other guards would handle it. I did exactly what he told me to do. My boyfriend's barracks weren't too far from the gate entrance, luckily, and after two turns, I would be completely out of sight of the gate. I waited for my boyfriend, and when he came out, I told him everything that happened. I was shaking and crying. He ended up driving us back to my place, and we exited from the main gate that was on the other side of the base. It was a longer drive home, but meant that we wouldn't run the risk of a guy possibly waiting on the side of a road to drive back out of base. When I took him back that night, guards had obviously done a shift change, but my boyfriend knew the one working and asked if she'd heard anything about the guy following somebody. She was very excited to tell us about the guy in the blue van who ended up being arrested by military police. As it turned out, the dude tried to tell the guard I was his daughter and was just being difficult, and could he please let him through to go and get me. The guard played it cool and pretended to be understanding, but said he needed to do a sweep of the car, and that they would have to have somebody escort him to find me, since he didn't have military ID or visitor pass. The guy tried to say no, but the guard insisted. The guy tried to get in through the gate on foot. Clearly not a good idea to try to force your way onto a military installation. He didn't even make it a quarter mile before MPs had pulled over and cuffed him, and they found a gun in his center console. I don't know what that guy would have done if he caught up with me. Maybe assaulted or killed any number of things. Who knows? I no longer live in that city. I'm no longer dating that boyfriend. I have new license plates on my car from my new state, and I have no idea what eventually happened to Mr. Astro. I'm sure he probably did some jail time, considering that he tried to gun it through a base with a firearm in the console, but I have no idea how much time, and I have no desire to try and find out what happened to him. It was in college. My roommate was a born-again Christian, and she invited me to her Bible study in church all the time. Eventually I went, and I kept going. Wasn't a fan of the pastor, but there were a lot of nice young adults who liked to have clean, sober fun, and I didn't drink or party, so I felt like I fit in. But I didn't agree with everything they believed in. Just the more normal stuff like God and helping the poor, not some other things. This one guy in the Bible study, Drew, was pretty quiet. Good looking. Seemed like he knew everything about the Bible, which amazed me. I thought, I know nothing about this. He's very wise. I was 21 and he was 27. He wasn't a college student. He just worked, which I later learned maybe he didn't. We were going to go on a young adult retreat, and because I worked, I couldn't leave early on Friday to drive up to the mountains with the girls in the group. Mutual friends said that I could ride with Drew, so I said okay. On the way up, Drew was pretty quiet for the first hour. Not very friendly at all, and it was a long trip, but as we got closer to the mountains, he really warmed up. We got pizza, and he paid, which was nice. Then he stopped the car just so we could look at the stars. He even played some Brian McKnight. He was turning it into a date, but I didn't know it or see it that way then. I was starting to really like him and felt like we had a connection. He's just about to drop me off at the girls' cabin when he suddenly gets very serious and tells me that something happened between him and another girl in our church group, but she is telling lies about him and to not believe whatever I hear. He doesn't explain what actually happened and doesn't say who it is. I enter the cabin and all the girls are there, and very quickly one girl, Bree, who is probably the youngest in the group, who is 19, tells all of us, "Ladies, there is a wolf in sheep clothing among us at this retreat." Now, if you don't know church folk, they get very dramatic and talk like this all the time. So I just thought, okay, here is some drama. She tells us a story about how she was talking to some guy here, but he started stalking her and wouldn't take no for an answer, and even threatened her sister. Now my spidey sense is up, and I realize this must be what Drew was telling me about. The church group doesn't know who it is because she won't say, because she doesn't want to gossip, and she says leadership will handle it. Well, Drew eventually leaves the weekend retreat early. There goes my ride back, I thought. I don't know if he was ever asked to leave or what. That week, Drew asks me to hang out, and we do. I still like him and don't know who to believe. On our hangout, we didn't really do anything. He takes me to the mall and reads the Bible to me. Okay, cool. Then he parks his car on some suburban lookout, top of the world type of thing, and just says that he is a view guy who really likes views. I'm not one to be impressed by suburban lights, so I'm just like, okay, well, this is boring. I give him another chance. I invite him to come see a play with me. When he does, he immediately meets one of my friends, Brian. Brian introduces us to his boyfriend, Nick. I'm in the theater, many gay friends. Well, for the majority of the rest of the date, Drew lectures me about how gays are going to hell, and I must not really love them if I don't stop to tell them that. I eventually cry because it is this ugly argument in his car that we were having for hours in the parking lot of Panera. I say, I want to go home. This is basically the worst date ever. I don't agree with what he says. He also tells me I need to give up my dream of being an actress because what if the Lord doesn't want me to do that? Theater is something I did my whole life, not to mention my major, and his reasons for giving it up had nothing to do with the impracticality of it, but because of God. This guy was nuts. I get home and I offer to make us some cocoa to just kind of end things as friends, or at least on a better note. I know I will see him at church, and we have mutual friends and are in the same Bible study. Things got weird. He tried to get sexual with me, but then also blamed me for tempting him. I ended up crying again. I just wanted him to go home, but I was so emotionally exhausted I didn't know what to make of this. He calls and texts me that week, and I don't respond. Then it's a Sunday night. I am talking to my friend Tim, who no longer goes to this church anymore. I tell him I went on a date with Drew. Before I can tell him how it went, Tim says, "What? That guy's crazy. You need to abort that mission." Tim tells me that he is close with Bree and her family, and Drew is a stalker and threatened Bree's sister. I don't know what to believe, because it sounds like Tim believes this just based on Bree's story. I hang up and I call my mom trying to tell her what happened, what Tim told me about Drew and how it was such weird timing considering what happened with me. While I'm on the phone with my mom, I get a knock at the door. It's 10 p.m. on Sunday night. I look out, but nobody's there. I go to get my roommate and ask her if she can just sit with me in the front room because I'm freaked out and think somebody's there. There's another knock at the door. I open it, and it's Drew, and he looks all in a frenzy. I asked him what he was doing here, and he said he just needed to talk to me, and I wasn't answering my phone, which was because I was genuinely busy earlier in the day. The conversation is getting long, and my roommate is still sitting there, so I tell her she can go back to her room. It's okay. I let him come in, because I'm conditioned to be overly nice, and this was a big mistake. We started talking, and as soon as my roommate is gone, he pulls out a knife and starts saying how he was worried my neighbors did something to me, because I wasn't answering his text, and he didn't know what kind of situation he'd be walking into. I have zero fighting skills, no experience in that situation at all. So I calmly say, as casually as possible, "Hey, can you put the knife away? It makes me feel uncomfortable." He asks me if I want the knife, and I say, "No, I just want to pretend it's not here." I somehow talk him down, get him to leave. I think I convince him that he still has a shot with me somehow. The next morning, my mind is clearer, and I feel like I need to tell my mom what happened. She has me tell my dad, who has me tell the church youth leader and security at my apartment. I tell a cop the whole story, and he says that this guy is definitely a stalker, and I will see him again unless the police call him. I say, "It's fine. I think everything's going to be okay. There's no need to call." I just didn't want any more drama. I had never talked to a policeman about anything before. I was still processing and didn't understand that this was serious. My mistake. The next night I went to a party, another church-related one, but Drew is not supposed to be here. He told me before that he wasn't going. Well, he is there. I decided to leave, but my 21-year-old self doesn't think to ask to have someone walk me out. I figure, if I leave, and he is still there, problem solved. I didn't anticipate him realizing I left and following me. I'm walking to my car, in a dark apartment parking lot, and I hear him call out my name. He's following me. I start running and say, "I don't want to talk." He begins chasing me. I am clicking my car to open, thinking this is how girls die, because she did not let the cop call the stalker, because she is dumb. Thankfully, my car unlocks and I get in and drive away. Problem is, this guy knows where I live. I move out 2 weeks later, and I block him on all social media and my phone. Drew eventually somehow managed to make another Facebook profile and sent me a message that Summer says he was praying for me and had forgiven me for trashing him to people, even though I still never told anyone what happened, except for the useless pastor who did nothing. That was the last I saw and heard of him. Unfortunately, this predator continued to serve at the church in the junior high ministries of all places, around many young girls. No one on church leadership listened to me, or to Bree, who both complained that this guy was stalking us. I never reached out to Bree to let her know what happened to me, and I never got to hear her story in detail. But I had told the young adult pastor about the knife, and him trying to get sexual with me and how I was scared. Thankfully, I didn't go to that church anymore. And this was all before the Me Too movement. What sucks is I've had a few experiences with crazy religious guys. This was the first, but not the last. And I'm still trying to come to terms with why that is. I guess I should give some background before I get into this story. I became homeless in late January, so I am living in my car with my 120-pound female Mastiff, who is a guardian breed. She keeps me very, very safe, and always has. We have a routine in the mornings. First, I walk her at my cousin's house. Then I go to a local rest stop to use the facilities and brush my teeth and wash my face and whatnot. After that, I go to a park and ride by the rest stop to walk my dog again. Because of the virus, lots of people frequent this park and ride to either sit and read, listen to podcasts or audiobooks, or to nap. Now, when I walk my dog, I leave the back door of my car open. Because she is old and has arthritis, and it's hard for her to get in and out of the car, I usually have to lift her up from her underbelly to load her into the car. I also leave it open that way because she is fear aggressive with humans due to being abused as a puppy, and she is a dog aggressive, so I like to make sure I can get her in the car quickly if I need to. I also like to park my car between a large van and an SUV that are seemingly abandoned there, or just left there for whatever reason, so that my car is kind of hidden and nobody will park next to me. Last week the van wasn't at the park and ride, so I parked to the left of the SUV, as usual, with a huge space between my car and any others in that row. I was walking my dog in the grass pretty far away from my car, and as usual, I had the car running with the back door slightly open. I was far enough from it that you wouldn't know it was mine if you passed it. While walking my dog, I noticed a flash of a silver car out of the corner of my eye. I thought it might be a state trooper, and if it was, because I have both paranoia and an anxiety disorder, that he might reprimand me for walking my dog there. I stayed calm and continued to walk my dog, intent on getting her to do her business, so we could get back in the car and leave. The car passed by once more, and I noticed it wasn't a state police car. It was a silver Honda with an old man driving. He was purposely driving as close as he could to my dog and I, without hitting the curb, and was literally just crawling the car along our path. When I turned around, he did too. He crept past once more, staring out of his open window at me the entire time and not even watching the road. I got agitated at that and resigned myself to the idea that I would have to confront him if he continued to stalk us. He passed by once more, crawling again and trying to get closer. When he realized I was headed for the cars, he turned around again. I got my dog, named Karma, in the car and settled myself into the driver's seat and took some time to give her a bowl of fresh, clean water and her treats and took a moment to plug in my laptop to my inverter and charge it for later. I saw the silver car out of the corner of my eye again and watched as the old man parked a few cars away from mine in the same row next to a man in a black pickup truck that I noticed was watching this old man curiously. I was thankful the man in the truck was there and watching and had noticed the way the old man was creeping by me and stalking me. The old man purposely reverse parked so his window was lined up with my driver's side window and continued to belligerently stare at me from out of his open window as I did what I needed to before I'd leave the park and ride. He was leaning against his door with his head out and just staring straight at me, not even blinking. I ignored him as I had been doing, carrying on with my business, when I plugged in my phone and organized the belongings in my front seat and gathered up some garbage to put in a little garbage bag I kept on the floor of the front seat. I was raised to be tough and unafraid, and I wasn't going to let this creepy old guy spook me. I looked up after about 10 minutes, and he was still staring right at me, still not even blinking. So I turned my head and avoided eye contact as I put on my seatbelt. I had been running the car the whole time I walked my dog, so I was good to go. I went to pull out of my spot, and my backup camera went off, and I saw that silver car right behind me, blocking me from pulling out of my parking spot. At this point, I was angry and ready to give this old man a what for, but I reminded myself that he just might be a little bit off, My grandpa had dementia, and before he was diagnosed, he did strange things and would often forget where he was, and he would hallucinate. I figured maybe this old man was having troubles of his own. The old man pulled up next to me, and as I put my car back in gear to leave, my dog began going wild, and I heard a voice. Mind you, I had locked all my doors and closed all my windows while this man was staring at me to make it clear that I was not to be approached and was not interested in conversation. My dog was climbing into my front seat and blocking off my view so I couldn't pull out. She was barking like crazy and snarling at this man, with her hair standing up on her back. At this point, I just stopped and put the car in park, shoved her into the back seat, and rolled down my window to see what this creep wanted. I noticed he had an oxygen tube in his nose, but there was no oxygen tank to be seen anywhere in his car. I have a good eye for these things because my grandma had one for 2 years before she died, and I also worked in a pharmacy where I delivered pharmacy supplies door to door at an elderly living community with a health center and assisted living center. I can spot an oxygen tank of any size and in any kind of container or case anywhere. There was none in his car. He says to me, "Are you all right?" So I say, "Yes, I'm fine." I go to roll my window back up when he speaks again. "Are you broken down? Do you need help?" I give him an incredulous look and firmly say, "No, I'm not. My car is fine and so am I." Again, I try to roll up the windows as he shouts, "Well, it looked like your car was broken down, which is why I pulled up here next to you. I think something's wrong with your car." Again, I tell him my car is fine. I'm fine. I don't need any help, and rudely thank him for his concern, but he doesn't let it go. He tells me once more that he thinks my car is broken down and that he can help me. At this point, I'm no longer trying to be polite. I give him a nasty look, don't even bother to stop my dog from barking at him, and I say, "I'm fine, thanks." He just nods and slowly, ever so slowly, crawls out of his parking space and down the lot towards the exit, and hangs there as if he's waiting for me to drive out. My instincts are telling me that something is really off with this guy, but I'm trying to rationalize, chalking it up to my paranoia, anxiety, and general distrust of people. I tell myself he's probably just a bit senile and means well. Still, I stay stubbornly in my spot and do not leave until he gives up and pulls out of the lot going the opposite way that I was going to. The whole day, the entire incident bothered me. It wasn't until later, when talking to my male friend, that I realized how messed up the whole thing was. He didn't know which car was mine when he began stalking me. I was nowhere near it. Once I got in my car, he pulled up a few spots away to purposely continue watching me, and seeing that my car was clearly fine and running since I was blasting the AC and rolled up my windows without any difficulty. I've had cars that have broken down before, and I'm mechanically inclined enough, as my friend pointed out. If my car was broken down, I would have at least had the hood popped, and I'd be elbows deep in my engine, checking my oil, my other fluids, my belts, radiator, battery, my alternator. Been there, done that a million times. Once again, he had the oxygen tube in his nose, and no tank anywhere in sight. I drive an SUV, and he was in a Honda sedan, so I was easily able to see into his vehicle, and nothing. The fact that he insisted something was wrong with my car bothered me. It was as if he wanted me to get out of the car to either check, probably thinking because I'm a young, small female that I don't understand mechanics, or know when something is wrong with my car, or to prove to him that it was fine. There were no signs at all that anything was wrong with my car, and if there was, I wouldn't be out walking my dog. I'd be elbows deep in the engine bay, on the phone with the towing company, and I would be highly stressed out and filthy. What's even more bothersome is he did this in broad daylight, with people watching from their cars. He purposely stalked me as close as he could with his car, nearly driving in the grass, turning around and creeping slowly past me 3 times, and following me as I walked, and then parked near my car once he saw me get in. I think he parked next to me and stared at me like that to try to take some time to figure out an excuse or a reason to approach me before he stopped me from leaving and pulled up next to me. The entire thing was incredibly uncomfortable, creepy, off, and gave me Ted Bundy vibes. After all, an elderly man with an oxygen tube in his nose doesn't look like he's capable of harming anybody. But oh boy, did he want me to get out of my car. Him hanging around the exit to try and catch me leaving was probably the worst of it all. It wasn't enough that he stalked and harassed me in the lot. No. Why not try to follow me where I was going? So old man in the park, with the oxygen tube that connected to nothing, let's not meet again. As a child, kindergarten age, I loved to talk. If anyone had a question for me, I would gleefully give them way too much information. Most people found it endearing and would praise me for being so smart, which encouraged me a lot. My mom and I normally shopped at the market just a few minutes away from our house. My mom had been shopping there for 20-some years at that point, and was friends with most of the workers, so I was friendly with them too, and was always happy to talk with them. Whenever my mom got distracted talking to someone, I, with the attention span of a 6-year-old, would wander around the aisle. My mom would keep an eye on me to make sure I didn't get too far, but if she was distracted, one of the other employees would usually be around and gently guide me back over. One day, though, we went to a different market that I couldn't remember having been to before, and we didn't go back to for nearly a decade. We were walking around the aisles when my mom ran into her friend. They started talking, and I, not realizing that I no longer had a store full of adults keeping an eye on me, started wandering around the aisle. My eyes caught some colorful display, I think flowers or balloons, and went over to look. Once I was satisfied with my inspection, I turned back to the aisle only to find that my mom wasn't there. That had never happened before. I looked around a little, though not moving from my spot near the colorful displays. Since it was right next to the registers, there was a decent amount of people nearby, which I'm thankful for now. As I was looking around, an employee came up to me. He was older than my sister. She was 12 or 13 at the time, and younger than my dad, in his mid-40s, which was the only way I could gauge age. Now I would probably say he was in his early to mid-20s if I remember right. "Hi there," he said sweetly, in that tone you normally speak to kids in. I cheerfully said hello, actually stepping a little bit closer. "Are you looking for your mommy?" I say yes, happily explaining that I had last seen her talking to her friend, and that I could normally find her easily when I wandered away, so I wasn't sure where she could have gone. "Does she leave you alone often?" "Not really. My older sister was normally with me, if my mom wasn't. She was 12 or 13, and she was super mature, so if my mom had to leave for a little bit, she knew I would be okay, and she never left us alone in public, just at home if she needed to run somewhere. Never for very long, just the length of a time of a Pokemon episode or something, and my dad was at work a lot, and didn't come back until late, usually, if you're wondering." "Where do you live?" "Well, wouldn't you know, I just learned my address. We just learned how to mail a letter in school. Even took a little class trip to the mailbox on our school corner to send them out. I knew how to write my address now, and I knew how to say it. You want to hear?" "Of course you do. I know kids are naive, but I was downright dumb. I was diagnosed with colorblindness 2 years later, otherwise known as red-green colorblindness. It makes sense. I was totally blind to all the red flags." "Where do you go to school? Who picks you up?" "Well, I go to the local elementary school. I don't know the address, though, sorry, but I know what street it's on, because I wait on the sidewalk for my mom, or daycare sitter, depending on the day, so I see the street sign a lot since I'm usually waiting for a while to be grabbed." "Do you like animals? You like puppies?" "Dogs scare me. Cats scare me. Pigeons scare me. Fish scare me. Flies scare me. You know what doesn't scare me? Turtles. I have 5 turtles. No dog that might bark or bite if someone drops by the house, like our neighbor does. Those dogs are always behind the gate, though, so they don't scare me a lot." It had only been a few minutes since I last saw my mom. Even with how much information I was dumping, I was a very fast talker. But I was starting to get a little antsy. Not because I was uncomfortable talking to a stranger, but because I had skipped lunch that day specifically to con my mom into letting me get a bagel from the store next door, which is why we were at that market in the first place. My mom was holding onto the bagel to make sure I didn't eat it too fast and choke, which I had done several times in the past. I wanted my bagel, and while I talked to this grown man who made me feel so smart and was oh so interested in my life. I liked bagels more. Plus, if I caught my mom when we were at the bakery section, I might be able to use my charm and cuteness to get a cookie. So I gotta find my mom now. Oh well, I'll walk around with you to help find her. You want to lead me through a marketplace you work at, where you can easily bring me to the back room, meat locker, or any number of places? Yeah, sounds good. Ozzy! I look around to see my mom. The relieved look on her face slowly changed into something more anxious. I smile happily and wave her over. She immediately grabs my hand, and I can tell she wants to chide me, probably for leaving the aisle. But she seems more occupied on the man in front of me. Before I can open my mouth to introduce him, or remember that I even got his name, he quickly says that he's glad I found my mom, and he needs to get back to work, and practically runs to the back of the store. My mom puts her hands on my shoulders and looks me in the eye, her expression a lot more worried now. What was he talking to you about? She asks, her voice more serious than I'd ever heard her. Can I have my bagel? My mom opens her mouth, pauses, and goes into her purse to hand me my bagel. Between bites, I happily tell her about the conversation and everything I remembered. My age, my grade, pickup schedule, likes and dislikes, my literal address. My mom gradually became paler, then became red with anger. She brought me over to the manager, and I don't remember much about the conversation. I got a cookie. I remember that pretty well. It was shaped like a watermelon, which was apparently far more important to me than paying attention to what was being said. The police were not called. We went home, and my mom told me I wasn't allowed to walk around the store anymore. No more talking to any strangers, even if they worked at the store that we were at, unless she was with me. If I ever saw that man again, I was to run away, find someone I know, and ask for help. If all else fails, scream at the top of my lungs, just like when a fly lands on me. I agree pleasantly, not really fazed by anything she's saying. I know that some people are bad, but bad people look bad, right? They talk mean, they look scary, and they try to grab you. But this guy didn't. So he wasn't bad, was he? But if my mom was saying it, then I would listen. I better enjoy that cookie, because we weren't going back to that store ever again. In exchange, I can get a donut once a month from our usual store. When I was around 12, our school had a safety assembly and was talking about the shady things adults do to get kids, in a very, very watered-down version of what they most likely wanted. And I'm sitting there, listening, and I suddenly realize, if my mom hadn't found me, something bad might have happened. If not in the store, then in front of my school. If not in front of my school, then my house. It's been a little over a decade later. Now I'm 18, and I've never seen the guy again, and let's keep it that way. I apologize if this gets lengthy. There's a lot to unpack here. This happened to one of my best friends and I back in 2017, and I felt like it's worth sharing. For some backstory, my best friend Elise was dating this guy Mark in 2016. They broke up right as New Year's was approaching. I've known Elise for over a decade, but we didn't talk much while they were together. I ran into them once at a local coffee shop, hugged her, and was chatting a while Mark stared at me in disgust, as if Elise wasn't allowed to talk to her friends. At the time, I thought nothing of it, assuming he was just antisocial. I had no idea he would go on to ruin an entire year of my life. It's really fuzzy as to how Mark got in contact with me specifically. I believe Elise posted about her breakup, and I offered my support publicly, so he targeted me. It began on New Year's Eve. He started messaging me on Instagram over and over, threatening me. I was having a get-together with my then-boyfriend, two of my now-ex-best friends, and my now-ex-best friend's boyfriend. I remember seeing my notifications blowing up and ignoring it. Everyone else seemed more concerned than I was. I brushed it off until late that next day. I checked my phone and I had dozens of DMs from Mark, as well as a few public posts that he tagged Elise and I in, calling us every name in the book and claiming I was the reason they broke up. I answered his DMs, asking why he was targeting me. That was the biggest mistake I ever made. After some angry messages from him, he blocked me, and I thought it was over. I also had some missed calls from Elise, so I finally contacted her and asked what was going on. She frantically told me that Mark was a dangerous man, and he's been tormenting her since the day they became a couple. He would throw her around his apartment, leaving awful bruises that she sent me photos of. He would threaten to commit suicide if she left him, and he even threw a hissy fit at a tattoo shop because they wouldn't tattoo Elise's first and middle name over his eyebrow. He got crybaby instead. Elise also informed me that Mark had went to jail before meeting her for domestic abuse. He stabbed his ex-girlfriend in the leg and was only behind bars for a month before his dad bailed him out. With this new information, I was terrified. Elise told me where he lived, and it was directly behind the coffee shop I mentioned earlier. I frequented that building and that part of town in general. That'll come into play later. I eventually calmed myself down and I forgot about him, until he got my phone number. I still don't know how he got it, but I woke up to 30-plus messages from him one day, and I was horrified. His messages included threats to kill himself if I didn't help him and Elise get back together, threats to kill me, cries for help, him blocking my number and then unblocking it, just to start the cycle all over again. I, being very naive and not wanting to be held responsible if he actually killed himself, did not block him. I asked him to leave me alone and if he wanted a hotline to where he could get some help, and he pretended to calm down for a bit. I gave him the number after many messages from him saying how much he missed Elise but also wanted to kill her. I told her immediately and pushed her to go to the cops, but she didn't. Her condition helped her believe that she would get into trouble if she reported him. This went on for months. I usually didn't respond, and when I did, he seemed to chill out for a bit. I'm skipping ahead to a particular night where Elise and I were hanging out at my house. We were chatting away on the phone, starting to light up. I ignored it and kept talking because I didn't want to be rude. Elise peeked at my phone and said, "It's Mark. Look." Sure enough, Mark was bombing my phone with threats to slit his own throat because he knew Elise was at my house, calling us both the C word and claiming it would be our fault if he died that night. I didn't answer, but what came next is something that still haunts me to this day. He sent a video, and being curious, I clicked on it. Elise watching over my shoulder. The video was of Mark's arm, a huge gash going down the middle. He was fake crying in the background saying, "You made me do this. I hate you both." He clenched his fist over and over again to make more blood squish out. Elise and I were so in shock that we watched the entire 50-second clip, despite how disturbing it was. I immediately called our local police station. Elise gave him his address, and an officer came to my house to view the video and take down some notes. While we waited for the police to arrive, Mark posted the gruesome video to his Instagram and unblocked Elise and I just to tag it, claiming we told him to do it. Being a conventionally attractive guy, the girls that swooned over him commented some pretty harsh things about us and kissed his butt like crazy. He was admitted to the hospital that night, and I wish they kept him. The harassment continued the second he got out. Time traveling a little more now to a few months later. Mark hadn't let up, and Elise and I were still very close. We had a friend, Kayla, visiting from across the country. She also had a run-in online with Mark and hated him, but wasn't afraid of him. She was always carrying more than one weapon, some pepper spray, and she knew how to fight. So she suggested we go take a walk in the part of town he lived in. She wanted to visit that coffee shop, see some of our small businesses, and then grab dinner at a pizzeria. Elise and I reluctantly agreed. We parked in front of the coffee shop, grabbed some drinks, and started walking down the road. Within about 5 minutes, Mark drove by on his motorcycle. Elise and Kayla were immersed in conversation as I trailed behind. I looked up and made eye contact with Mark. Elise and Kayla noticed him as he was speeding off. Kayla assured us he wouldn't get anywhere near us with her around, so he kept walking. Mark began circling the block we were walking on with his bike. As we crossed to the next block, he switched to that block and circled it too. On the third block was the pizza place. Their walls are all glass, all see-through, of course. We went in and were seated in the corner, right next to the glass. We sat there for about an hour and a half, eating, talking, and sipping on soda. Mark circled the restaurant the entire time, and we did our best to ignore him. Once we were finished up and got to leave, Mark sped off and we didn't see him again that evening. Some time passed, and Mark began riding by Elisa's house every night. Within a week, he started doing the same to me. I told my parents and my stepdad, who kept a close eye on the street. My mom always made sure our doors and windows were locked and shades were shut before going to bed. My dad would even do a nightly patrol where he would drive around my street for a few minutes on his way home from work since he no longer lived there. He would call me and let me know that the coast was clear as he was leaving. I still woke up almost every night to the sound of his motorcycle engine revving outside my house. We had no proof of this to show the police, because he was somehow doing this without a trace, so we did not bother reporting it. At the end of 2017, Mark took his motorcycle and sped off to California to avoid the legal trouble he'd gotten in here. Elise and I were relieved, to say the least. He still harassed us from time to time, but he never came back. We stopped hearing from him after a while, and we thought nothing of it. Fast forward one last time to September 2019. Elise and I were out and about, enjoying the sunshine, when she got a phone call. Mark was dead. He had died right after his calls and messages to us stopped. He got into his car with his new drug dealer in Arizona and pissed them off enough for them to shoot him. He died instantly. He also caught two more domestic violence charges in California and Arizona and was on the run from his warrant. His father told everyone it was an accidental overdose because Mark was known for abusing Xanax and other miscellaneous drugs. But it was fun to cover his sociopath son's butt. I'm not sure if Mark's death was karma or some higher being protected us and all of those girls. He's hurt before and would hurt in the future, but he's gone. We never have to worry about our safety because of him again, although seeing photos of him still does give me the creeps.
Well, y'all, that is my time. I hope y'all have enjoyed the show. Y'all already know the vibes. Thanks to all those who called in. Whether you stayed or not, I appreciate the support and the love. Those of you who hit my inbox and my DM, look, listen. You are always thought about, even when I don't do shows and things like that. You are greatly appreciated because y'all are the ones that I do this stuff for because y'all appreciate it. And as long as y'all appreciate me, I shall appreciate y'all. But as always, show up next time tomorrow, same time, same place. I'm all discombobulated because I hit the breeze a little bit too hard tonight. But before I leave out of here, I'm going to leave y'all with my thought of the night. And my thought of the night is this. It is okay to be yourself. It is okay to think for yourself. Because the moment that you start being someone else, and thinking as someone else does, that is the very moment that you lose the fabric of what makes you you. And that's the thin line between what's real and what's flawed. So with that being said, love, peace, and blessings. Pray before you night. I love y'all.